associated legal businesses to its downtown instead. When San Bernardino officials were preparing their plans to escape bankruptcy in 2015 and 2016, this change of locale added an extra small humiliation. They had to get in their cars and take the short but traffic-choked drive down I-215 to present the plans to a federal judge sitting in Riverside. San Bernardino's reliance on heavy industry made it more vulnerable to disruption during difficult times. But the surprise we found in talking with the representatives of both towns was how much a cultural and governing difference mattered in Riverside's ascent and in San Bernardino's long struggles. At a small barbecue restaurant in Riverside, I met Ronald Loveridge. If he had done his work in a bigger East Coast town, more people around the country would probably recognize his name. Loveridge, who grew up in Northern California and was student body president and valedictorian at the University of the Pacific in Stockton, went on to get his doctorate in political science at Stanford and then took a teaching position at the relatively new University of California, Riverside. In his early 40s, he ran for and won a seat on the Riverside City Council in 1979. "Why go from the academy to elected office?" he asked in an essay about his time as mayor, a question that was relevant, since, to the best of his knowledge, no other full-time professor in the University of California system had held elective city office. He said there were a number of reasons to take the plunge. Prime among them, the nearly unlivable impact of smog in inland Southern California at the time. I did know what he was talking about. As a high school student, I'd been to track meets where you fell over coughing, and tennis matches where you could hardly see the person serving from the other side of the court. Knowledge of those years tempered some of my horror at China's air pollution during our time there. But when Leverage first came to Riverside, more than half of the days per year had stage one smog emergencies, and almost a quarter had stage two, in which people were supposed to restrict their activities. For comparison, now entire years go by with no stage one alerts. Leverage ran for mayor in 1993, and ran again, and again, and again, until he had been elected to five straight four-year terms. He finally stepped down as mayor in 2012, having spent 32 years in city office while still teaching at UC Riverside. "What," I asked him, "turned the city around?" Confronting the air quality emergency was the immediate challenge, and dealing with it was, of course, not just a local issue, but a statewide one. He told me, "Smog then, in the 60s and 70s, was unavoidable and terrible. Republican, Democratic, conservative, liberal, you saw it and breathed it, and it took years to cope with it. You'd work so hard, and the people would say, 'Why is the air still so bad?'" As the state and the region began enacting increasingly ambitious air quality programs, the next big challenge for Riverside was one common to many cities from the 1970s onward. Its downtown, which had taken on the hollowed-out and derelict look of many cities where business was moving toward the suburbs. The situation was more acute in Riverside than in some other cities because one property loomed so large. This was the Mission Inn, a fantastical Spanish, Moorish, Hollywood structure built mainly in the early 1900s in the middle of Riverside's downtown, and very popular over the next half century as a stylish Southern California resort. Pat and Richard Nixon were married there, as was Betty Davis. Ronald and Nancy Reagan went there on their honeymoon. When U.S. presidents made swings through the West, it was a usual stop. In the main lobby, you can't miss the oversized chair made especially for President William Howard Taft. The Mission Inn hosted writers, Hollywood stars, Amelia Earhart, Andrew Carnegie, and Helen Keller. The hotel had the role later associated with Palm Springs. And as Palm Springs became more popular and developed, the Mission Inn slowly faded. In the mid-1970s, it was sold to the city's redevelopment agency. A decade later, it had changed hands several times, and then it closed altogether for some 7 years. A huge, vacant, strange eyesore occupying a full block at the heart of downtown. I don't know a successful city that doesn't have a strong downtown, Loveridge said when I spoke with him. The city government helped find grants for and a new owner of the Mission Inn, which reopened in the 1990s and is now successful. We stayed overnight at the hotel, wending through mazes of hallways to reach our room, which overlooked the courtyard abloom in Southern California flora, where diners enjoyed old-time splendor. We toured the public rooms, including an art gallery, a music room, a chapel, an extensive collection of Asian artifacts, the famous flyers wall, festooned with copper wings, commemorating famous flyers who had come to the hotel, and we drooled over a set of rooms called Author's Row, where, you guessed it, famous authors have stayed to work. We lingered over beers in the presidential lounge. Leverage led an investment in public art through the downtown area and walking and bike paths to bring students and families downtown, and other elements that were becoming familiar to us from cities across the country. In an effort known as the Riverside Renaissance, the city channeled more than $1.5 billion in public and private investment into downtown recovery and other public works. Near the end of Leverage's term, he commissioned a survey from an independent polling organization, which found that some 85% of the people in the city felt it was heading in the right direction. It concluded, Riversiders across racial, age, and income groups are uniformly happy with their overall quality of life and proud to live and work here. I am wary of any report that says uniformly, but there was little dissent about the city turning itself around. A few days before I met Ronald Loveridge, Deb and I had spent several hours downtown with Loveridge's successor, Mayor Rusty Bailey, a fifth-generation Riversider from an orange-growing family who had gone to West Point and become an Army helicopter pilot, then decided to come back home. An athletic man in his 40s, he greeted us early in the morning as he dismounted from his bike, having ridden in from his home to City Hall. We had breakfast at a coffee shop that was across a brick-paved walking street from the now-busy Mission Inn itself. As we sat and ate at an outdoor table, passers-by stopped every minute or two to say hello to their mayor and ask him about local schools or redevelopment plans. After we'd finished breakfast, big, gooey huevos rancheros for me, something neater for Deb, a fruit selection for the mayor, we walked toward his office in City Hall, with its expansive outdoor deck and views of the whole city across the local hills and out to Redlands. We strolled down the pedestrian-only Main Street Mall, whose Peace Walk section was decorated at regular intervals with larger-than-life-size statues of world figures from Martin Luther King to Mahatma Gandhi, and locally renowned leaders like Ismael Villegas, who was born in the Mexican-American part of Riverside and died in combat in the Philippines during World War II. He was just a day short of 21 years old when he was killed. After the war, Harry Truman conveyed a posthumous Medal of Honor to his family. A statue of Cesar Chavez is there as well, along with representations of farm workers crouched over to pick crops like those that grew in the fields around Riverside. Another depicts Do San, born as An Chang Ho, a hero of Korea's struggle for independence from Japan before World War II, and a leader of California's sizable Asian immigrant community. The city's population is slightly more Latino than the state's as a whole, just over half in Riverside versus about 40% for the state, with about a third of Riverside's people being non-Hispanic white, and about 8% each for African Americans and Asian Americans. For the whole state in 2015, the figures were around 40% for both Latinos and non-Hispanic whites, 13% for those of Asian background, and 6% for blacks. The Peace Walk and the statues that lined it were products of Ronald Leverage's campaign to revive the downtown. Aside from D.C., there's no other city with something like this, Leverage, who had by then left office, said when the final statue on the walk of Cesar Chavez was unveiled in 2013. It's a social justice walkway. Why had Riverside been able to pull off its Recovery Act, the Mission Inn and surrounding retail areas, the once decrepit and now viable Fox Theater, the tech startups, the medical and university complexes, when its one-time counterpart, San Bernardino, had struggled so badly? Mayor Rusty Bailey ran through the list of obvious reasons. The presence of the University of California, which attracted other institutions. The unique handicap of San Bernardino's governing structure. The series of economic blows San Bernardino had endured as all its major employers shut down. March Air Force Base, in the canyonland outside Riverside, remained open, transitioning to an air reserve base even as San Bernardino's mainstay Norton shut down. But then he emphasized two additional structural issues. One was Riverside's public ownership of the city's utilities, water, electricity, and sewage, which was a legacy of early 1900s progressive-era reform and which kept what would have been utility company profits in the city's treasury. Riverside has this in common with a handful of other California cities, the best known of which is Pasadena. There was that visionary community spirit from the start, Bailey said. It gave us a chance to control our physical destiny. There have been political raids on it over the past century, he noted, mainly from conservatives who thought this looked like city-scale socialism. But we've been able to defend it. The other factor was what Bailey called the density of social capital, a phrase I'd also heard from Ronald Leverage. It was the idea that Riverside had been and remained a place that people felt they were from and of. It's a place for families, Bailey said, with parks, strong public schools, outdoor festivals, recreation centers. Starting around 2000, as housing prices soared in the coastal cities in Los Angeles and Orange counties, Riverside became an attractive, affordable residential alternative for young families. We've mainly been managing population growth through that time, Bailey said. Some 40,000 students attend the universities, professional schools, and community colleges in the area. But, he pointed out, it's retained its sense of place. We've gotten used to asking people around the country what cities were their models and targets. People in Sioux Falls said they were looking at Omaha. In Greenville, they were looking at Atlanta, but in a cautionary way to avoid the effects of congestion and sprawl. Fresno was looking at Davis or Sacramento. Poor San Bernardino was too hard-pressed to think about more than itself. Rusty Bailey said that Riverside had now dared think of places like Pasadena and Santa Barbara as its next models, though he was quick to add, as anyone in California would, that such cities were now struggling with the effects of being so attractive to so many people, starting with astronomical real estate prices. We still want to be a place for families, where people can afford to live, he said, and then began telling us about how much a new light rail system would enhance the livability and sustainability of the town. I asked Bailey the same question I'd asked Don Ness in Duluth and Knox White in Greenville, and other mayors whose city's success might seem to be the basis of their own future political ambitions. Did he want to run for higher office? Higher, he said. This is the highest office, right here.
The entire California navel orange industry originated with two small trees that that suffragist, abolitionist, and spiritualist Eliza Tibbetts planted outside her Riverside kitchen door in 1873. Tibbetts was 50 years old at the time, having come from the East to Riverside by transcontinental train to San Francisco, then by boat to Los Angeles, and finally traveling overland to the Inland Empire to settle with her husband, Luther Tibbetts. Luther had arrived a few years earlier to join a new utopian community that was based on ideals of political justice. Eliza Tibbetts's earlier life was, well, colorful. She was a member of the Swedenborgian Church, whose adherents followed the teachings of the mystic and scientist Emanuel Swedenborg. She became a spiritualist, well known as an accomplished medium for her sought-after seances and fortune-telling. She and Luther had tried and failed to establish a new colony for freedmen and whites in Virginia in 1867. Then, as a suffragist, she'd marched with Frederick Douglass to Washington in 1871. Riverside was remote in the 1870s. You forded the Santa Ana River to get to San Bernardino when you needed to find skilled labor. And to get a newspaper, you drove a buckboard wagon to Los Angeles. Just a few months into life in California, Eliza, searching for a stable cash crop for her family, contacted an acquaintance from her days in Washington, D.C., a horticulturalist with the Department of Agriculture named William Saunders, who experimented with imported plants in his greenhouse on the National Mall. Her timing was perfect. Saunders had just heard about a promising species of oranges from Bahia in Brazil. He received a dozen young trees and grafted buds from them onto rootstocks. Not all of them survived, but two that he sent to Eliza Tibbetts at her request flourished in Riverside's soil and climate. Thus began the story of Washington naval oranges in California. Part of the tale, apocryphal or not, is that Tibbetts nurtured along the two little trees with dirty dishwater from her kitchen. Jim says that in his youth, he was taken on a ritual pilgrimage with his elementary school class from next door Redlands to pay respects at the site of Eliza's original tree. I spoke with Eliza's great-great-granddaughter, Patricia Ortlieb, an artist and psychotherapist who, with co-author Peter Economy, memorialized Eliza in the heavily researched book, Creating an Orange Utopia. The first fruit was picked in 1875 from the trees of Tibbetts's neighbors, to whom Eliza had sold buds to graft. By 1882, 500,000 so-named Washington navels were growing in California, all as grafts from the two original Tibbetts trees. The industry changed the state and the region. In Riverside, the allied industries of irrigation systems, grove expansion, orange sorting and packing, and refrigerated shipping catapulted the town's prosperity to the highest per capita income in the entire United States in 1893. But the Tibbetts had missed out. Eliza and Luther, complex, unusual, impetuous, litigious, and definitely not the best financial planners, had gone for quick money selling their buds for grafting instead of planting groves themselves. They also subdivided their land and sold off much of their property during the real estate boom that accompanied the explosion of the orange industry. By 1887, the first area real estate bubble had burst. The Tibbetts continued their lifelong string of legal disputes and lost their remaining property in foreclosure. Eliza Tibbetts died in a spiritualist colony near Santa Barbara in 1898. Today, there is a stunning bronze statue of a ballerina-like Eliza Tibbetts in the company of social justice heroes along Riverside's downtown Peace Walk. It portrays a beautiful young woman with a remarkably pinched waist and arms raised in hope and an uplifting posture. The loveliness of the statue is all the more striking when you compare it with any photo of Eliza Tibbetts taken during her lifetime. She actually showed a stronger resemblance to Queen Victoria than to a ballerina. Eliza Tibbetts was buried in Evergreen Cemetery in Riverside, in a grave that remained unmarked until nearly a century later, in 1993.
Redlands, California. Redlands, near both San Bernardino and Riverside, is my own hometown, a city I had in mind throughout this journey. From the perspective of either of the bigger cities, Redlands has always had it easy. It is smaller and more contained than the other two, with a better educated, richer, and whiter population than the other two cities, and with a greater proportion of its residential area, filled with pre-World War II homes that range from California craftsman-style bungalows to Georgian or Victorian-style houses. In many details, from its street-side look to its abundance of cultural and civic uplift organizations, to its series of public concerts dating back more than a century, Redlands presents itself as a special, coherent community. This is all the more reason why Joan Didion's famous Some Dreamers of the Golden Dream article for the Saturday Evening Post in the 1960s came as such a shock to Redlands residents. This is the California where it is easy to dial a devotion but hard to buy a book, she wrote. This is the country of the teased hair and the capris and the girls for whom all life's promise comes down to a waltz-length white wedding dress and the birth of a Kimberly or a Sherry or a Debbie and a Tijuana divorce and a return to hairdresser school. But nothing in Redlands' past or its self-conception seems immediately to answer a question that parallels Riverside's rise and San Bernardino's long struggle. That question is why Redlands, with its orange groves and its medical complexes and its beautiful small university, should have ended up as the home of one of the world's dominant middle-sized tech companies, whose growth and success have profoundly changed the town. The company is Esri. Its current name is derived from what started out in the 1960s as a two-person nonprofit called the Environmental Systems Research Institute. Esri is now very much for-profit and still privately owned by its founders, Jack and Laura Dangermond, with tens of thousands of employees worldwide and some 4,000 in Redlands itself. Most are well-paid, if perhaps not by Silicon Valley standards, then certainly by the standards of the Inland Empire, where living expenses in general are much lower, and attractive houses go for perhaps one-quarter what they would cost in Palo Alto or Menlo Park. Nearly all of these workers are well-educated, as engineers, project managers, and sales officials for a high-tech company. Although people at Esri don't like this comparison, the company's mainstay ArcGIS software can be thought of as the heavy-duty professional version of Google Earth. The company was the commercial pioneer in the GIS field, the abbreviation stands for Geographic Information Systems, and its customers include most national, regional, and city governments around the world, as well as most big companies who use it for everything from planning new store location sites to keeping track of pothole repairs and traffic flow in cities. Most members of Esri staff in Redlands come from someplace else. India, the United Kingdom, France, Germany, Canada, Australia, China, and computer science departments across the United States. They have brought to Redlands a high-end international and cosmopolitan note it would lack otherwise, except for the international medical talent attracted by Loma Linda's medical school and hospital and academic recruits at the University of Redlands. Through much of the 20th century, Redlands' ethnic makeup had been an Anglo-Latino balance. Among the whites, there were large groups of Dutch immigrants and their descendants, as in Holland, Michigan, Mormons, whose forebears settled the area in the 1840s and 1850s, before being recalled to Utah by Brigham Young, and Dust Bowl-era emigres from the plains and the south. Among the Latinos, nearly all were Mexican, and many of those were from families that had been in the area for several generations, having first come north after the Mexican Revolution of the early 1900s. Now a big tech company changes the faces of the people on the streets and in the parks and at the schools. The new arrivals have also meant a new demand for restaurants, entertainment, local retail stores, and other attributes of cities that seem economically alive, and museums, concerts, and other markers of a healthy civic culture. Why and how? In the simplest terms, it is all because the founders, Jack and Laura Dangermond, had grown up in Redlands and met in high school there, and they decided that a relatively remote, small-town setting was better for the overall life balance they wanted to have and the corporate culture they wanted to create than either Cambridge, Massachusetts, where Jack had done original GIS work as a graduate student at Harvard, or the San Francisco area, which was the default location for new tech companies even in the late 1960s. Jack Dangermond's father was an immigrant from Holland who worked as a gardener and ran a small nursery with his wife, who was American-born but whose parents were themselves also from Holland. Jack's original degree was in landscape architecture. Laura's mother worked in the local post office, and her father repaired televisions. Jack's parents knew mine, but I didn't come to more than a nodding acquaintance with him and Laura until we were all grown. I moved away from Redlands. They moved back. And I asked them, why here? Why did you return and stay? Their answers have boiled down to a variant of the theme we first heard from Jeff Padnos and Bob Peacock, and then encountered in different forms in different places along the way. Why here? We had asked Padnos about his little town of Holland and Peacock about Eastport. Where else? Each had, in essence, replied, half-jokingly and half-in-earnest. The Dangermonds have given a similar half-and-half response about staying in Redlands. The half that's joking is Jack Dangermond's immediate riff-retort, who wouldn't want to be in Redlands? When he's talking with me, it's followed by, and of course we know you'll move back here sooner or later. When he's talking with someone from Paris or Boston or Palo Alto, his tone seems non-defensive, as if signaling a willingness to laugh about the improbability of his company's setting. The extended version of the argument, which I've heard on visits to Esri's headquarters, and, for instance, when talking with him after he's completed hour-long keynote addresses to crowds of 16,000 international attendees at Esri's annual user conference in San Diego, where Dangermond, lanky and loose-limbed in his early 70s, is as focused as Steve Jobs was during his Apple presentations, is that a remote location is a trade-off, but a valuable one. He and Laura get to live as normal a life as anyone in their positions might. He drives around in a beat-up car. He eats in the local restaurants. He's known as a benefactor and by far the richest man in town, but otherwise he has a surprisingly undistorted existence. He is something of a rock star at his annual conferences of many thousands, but in Redlands he is quietly and quite anonymously Jack. And while the company loses some potential recruits who prefer the buzz of Palo Alto or West Los Angeles, and while Jack spends probably half of the year on the road, with customers or at conferences, usually flying on a commercial flight from nearby Ontario Airport, location reinforces the cultural model he has in mind for the company. 20-something singles are less interested in Redlands than in Santa Monica. 30-something parents with young children like the idea of the town's lower-cost housing, 5-minute commutes, strong public schools. This, in turn, has helped the company reinforce a lower-key, less flashy, minimal number of jerks cultural model, in contrast, say, to Apple's or Microsoft's reputation in their fastest-growing, elbows-out years. In late December of 2017, Jack and Laura Dangermond attracted the attention of the environmental and philanthropic world with the announcement that they had given $165 million to preserve in perpetuity 38 square miles of unspoiled California coastline around Point Conception. "We're very intentionally setting out a model that we hope other people with money will follow," Jack Dangermond told me when I asked him about the donation. "We'd like other wealthy people to think, let's do what the Dangermonds did. We'd like them to copy us." Perhaps there is no larger Redlands model to draw from the transformation of this one town by this one company. Jack and Laura Dangermond liked Redlands because they grew up there. And when I think of small towns where we might live, this is naturally first on my list for just the same reason. The broader significance is, once again, how often we came across stories like this, albeit about someplace else. Bob Peacock thought Eastport was the only place to be. Tracy Taft didn't start in Ajo, nor Larry Gross in Charleston, but once each of them found the right place, it was theirs. Even in an age of flux and seeming homogenization, regional imprinting is strong. And while we often hear of that in an immobilizing sense, as with people trapped in declining coal regions, such local patriotism turns up surprisingly frequently as an explanation for which towns or regions developed the way they did. You can't make a formula out of hoping that a locally raised couple goes off for schooling and then decides that the right place for a tech startup is back home, and decades later, that company becomes a big international success. But these local attachments, plus local ownership, and the sense of local patriotism we felt in places otherwise as dissimilar as Sioux Falls and the Golden Triangle and Redlands really matter in the fate of a town.
Ryan Burke, a millennial Redlander, grew up nurturing a passion for food and traveling, a route that took him around the world and eventually back to Dream in his native Southern California. Burke was one of the first to attend and graduate from the Grove School, the small Montessori-based charter school in Redlands. The school is centered on a working farm among the orange groves of the town. Students tend animals and grow crops, some of which they sell to local restaurants. Like all the other students there, Burke did internships and service work. And from his early teens, he was a dishwasher and a busboy for a Thai family at their local restaurant. After high school, Burke went on to culinary school. He saved up his money and set out to roam the world as a photojournalist, absorbing a core lesson he has since applied. Food and local culture are essentially intertwined. Back home, Burke was again working at a restaurant, with some of its ingredients, frozen fish, packed in super coolants. "Liquid nitrogen," Burke mused, "why not use it to quickly freeze ice cream?" Burke was not the first to think of this possibility, but he came to it on his own, he told me. He started playing around with the idea, and discovered that, indeed, you could almost instantly freeze the liquid base into a smooth, creamy ice cream. And that was when it all came together. The lessons he described from the Grove School to just get out there and do it, a passion for food, his self-described perfectionism for what he does. I found Ryan Burke one sunny midday just before Christmas as I was stopping at his A la Minute ice cream shop and he was heading out. With a small-town friendliness, seeming as if he had all the time in the world, he told me his own personal story, the new story of starting the business with his wife Cassie, who runs the financial side of the company, and about how their business works. The list of ice creams on the A la Minute board says a lot about the creativity of the owners and their commitment to being local. The flavors are inspired by local ingredients, honey from Southall Farms, mint from the Burke's own garden, local Redlands oranges, and nearby sourced olive oil, apples, lavender, pumpkins, and more that come and go with the seasons. I chose the orange honey. I was in Redlands, after all. It was truly delicious, and I say that with confidence as an ice cream connoisseur. Then Burke asked if I'd like to see his even newer shop, Parliament Chocolate, just a few blocks away. Parliament, as in a parliament of owls, was named for an early tenant of the building, the White Owl Cafe. The chocolate shop had opened just a few days earlier. Parliament Chocolate is the Burke's second dream. Once they had saved enough from ice cream, they turned to chocolate. Makes sense to me. He talked about the process of making his chocolate from sourcing his beans on a recent trip to small farms in Belize and Guatemala, to outfitting the shop, to producing the exquisite finished candies. It was all in the details. "Look at that drain," he said exuberantly, pointing to the floor and then to every carefully chosen fixture, tile, machine, and drawing in the tiny gleaming shop. I watched the Parliament chocolate makers tend big rotating vats of chocolate, ladle small scoops onto trays, and decorate them like miniature works of art. The 5-minute amble from Citrus Avenue along Fifth Street to East Redlands Boulevard is irresistible. Between the A la Minute ice cream shop and Parliament Chocolates is Augie's Coffee House. Austin Amento, with his father, an electrical contractor, bought Augie's, a small coffee shop, about 5 years ago. They didn't know much about the business, but saw an opportunity in an uncertain economic climate. After a few years, they decided to go all in, to ramp up. Their mission and brand would set them apart. Finding the best coffee beans, controlling every aspect of the bean roasting, the coffee brewing, and the costs, creating a new ambiance for the customers. The shop took on a fresh new look. The Amentos met with growers who came to California, and they eventually traveled to Colombia to see and buy for themselves. They went to San Francisco to learn about roasting, and they catered to their clientele, whom Austin describes as everyone, meaning people from the University of Redlands, the high schoolers, and the tech crowd from Esri. Amento said that one of Augie's aims is to educate their customers as the Amentos educated themselves, switching brews as many as 4 times a day for comparisons and contrast. Some customers, Amento told me, would come in that many times to learn about and to drink the different coffees. Augie's hooked me. Every time I went to the shop to buy beans, I was offered a coffee or tea on the house, which I found charming and personal and a compliment to the conversations struck up with other customers standing in line. So, did you go to the beer fest at Sylvan Park last week? From ice cream to chocolate to coffee, microbreweries, including the granddaddy of them all, Hangar 24, and sandwich shops and small boutiques, Redlands is peppered with inventive startups and charming options. A lot of the loveliest classic buildings will never return, having given way to modern buildings of the 1960s and 70s. But others show promise in preservation. Today's Starbucks is in a building preserved from the beloved former La Rosita drive-in. The old Redlands Daily Facts building will be the site of the new Museum of Redlands. Soon to follow, everyone hopes, will be the redevelopment of the failed downtown Redlands Mall, now a deserted and closed 1960s mall that serves the community only with its big outdoor parking lot. We heard that the plans called for a mixed-use complex, street-level retail plus upper-story condos, a renovation model we met all across the country. Then there are new markets, talk of a train, biking routes already in place, and the protection of groves and green hills. I think my favorite institution in Redlands, where I've spent enough time during my life that I earned a pin from the town elders identifying me as an official Redlander, is the YMCA. Jim would probably argue that his favorite is the Smiley Library. The Y has a special feature, the annual circus production. For those of you who have always dreamed of running off to join the circus, here is your second best chance. Move to Redlands and join the YMCA. This is not just a tumbler's wannabe circus. It is the Great Y Circus, founded by a former performer with the Ringling Brothers and Barnum & Bailey Circus, Roy Kobel, shortly after he moved to town in 1929. There are high-flying acts, trapeze stunts, maneuvers on the rings, unicycles, acrobatics, juggling, you name it, with performers as young as toddlers who train for several months each year and play to sell-out crowds inside the YMCA gym, which has extra-high ceilings designed to accommodate the show. Adults I know in town still have their childhood Y unicycles hanging in their garages. I didn't sign up for the Y Circus, but I did get a membership to swim in the pool regularly while we were in Redlands as a base for West Coast reporting and then writing. By now, I calculate that during our time on the road, I've swum multiple times in more than 20 pools, plus about 8 lakes or rivers. To figure further, let's round up and say that 30 spots at 10 times each, at 1,000 meters a pop, coming to 300,000 meters or nearly 200 miles of swimming across the country. I found YMCAs in more than half the towns we visited. Several others had pool complexes run by the city or the county or organizations like the Salvation Army. You might be tempted to think a pool is a pool, but I have to tell you, you'd be wrong. A public pool, like a public library, often reveals something about the spirit and culture of a town. Sometimes it's bright side and sometimes it's dark. The ethos of the public pools that I experienced is to be democratic and generous. The staff there welcome strangers. They make day passes easy. They seem generally pleased to see you. In Rapid City, South Dakota, when I scurried in for the last 45 minutes of the open hours at the gleaming new Y, the woman at the desk said I surely wouldn't get my money's worth, $5, with so little time left in the day, so she'd catch me on the next visit. I swam as fast as I could for as long as I had, and when I left, she asked if I'd enjoyed my swim. I returned the next day, careful to have allowed more time. Swimming at public pools is a chance to rub shoulders with people I wouldn't ordinarily meet as a visitor in town. In Redlands, there was a woman I saw regularly who lived at the Y during a good chunk of every midday I swam there. She methodically lined up her overstuffed plastic bags along the locker room counter. She showered long and hot and rested often on a comfortable chair. Her legs were red and swollen and did not look good at all. She reminded me of the homeless people I frequently saw organizing themselves to spend the day inside public libraries. I asked about the woman once, wondering about her story. The staff told me quietly that, oh, yes, they knew about her. She doesn't seem to cause anyone problems, was the incomplete but discreet answer. I saw cross-sections of the towns at many of the public pools. In Burlington, Vermont, the old pool in the old building's old basement was empty except for me and, improbably, a very big and strong African-American guy, a 20-something swimmer, who left a big wake and seemed to be training seriously. In Holland, Michigan, a town founded by Dutch Calvinists, I first saw many of the town's nearly 25% Hispanic population on a Saturday afternoon, when many of the families poured into the Holland Community Aquatic Center, the children exuberant. The names of the swim team record holders on the bragging board included Dutch Vans and Hispanic Garcias. In Columbus, Mississippi, a few stray octogenarians paddled around in the overheated pool. Only in Mississippi did I find a reminder that the Y was, in fact, the Young Men's Christian Association. A big bowl at the reception desk held what I first mistook for candy and later discovered were actually tiny paper scrolls, each with a typewritten proverb. In the heart of Greenville, South Carolina, a short walk from the gentrified Main Street on one side and the low-income urban neighborhood on the other, is one of the more bustling public rec centers where I swam. The Salvation Army Ray and Joan Kroc Core Community Center, where all slices of Greenville showed up. There are sports courts, a childcare room, a soccer field, tennis courts, gyms, a boys and girls club, two pools, and at the end of the building, a chapel. There are moms in yoga clothes, older ladies in water exercise classes, and little kids from the next door A.J. Wittenberg Elementary School of Engineering, who regularly walk the few hundred yards to take lessons and swim in the pool. In Austin, Texas, I swam in the brisk, spring-fed, WPA-era deep eddy pool all through my graduate school years, and again later whenever we returned, summer or not. The deep end is full of serious lap swimmers, and the shallow end packed with families with young kids. And the showers are set in an open-air tropical paradise where you can look up at live oaks while you rinse off. At my neighborhood pool in Washington, D.C., a town that proudly boasts at least 29 public pools, there's a woman who visits almost every summer morning at a picnic table in the park next to the pool, reading the paper or a book, her two corgi-looking dogs resting on the cool concrete beside her. She is there when I arrive and there when I leave. We say our hellos. I was anticipating a British accent, but she actually spoke with a southern lilt. One day I commented on the grapes she was eating, and she offered to share them with me, and on the small pile of tangerines she had balanced into a pyramid. They reminded me of offerings at a Buddhist shrine. Every day since, even if she has come and gone early, she leaves a little something arranged on the picnic table for passers-by like me to enjoy. A design from her orange peels, some fruit, and once a delicate bird's nest. If you missed the 1950s, or if you hanker for them again, you can recapture them at a few of the pools I visited. In Sioux Falls, I chose the Frank Olson Pool, run by the city's Department of Parks and Rec, in a leafy residential part of town. It was filled with kids who had ridden their bikes to the pool, propped them against the chain-link fences, and were whiling away their afternoons until it was time to ride home for dinner. This was surely part of what people in Sioux Falls meant when they described their life there as safe and easy. In Bend, Oregon, the town's Juniper Swim and Fitness Center has one of the nicest aquatic areas I have ever seen, set within the natural beauty of this picture-perfect high desert town. There's a water slide worthy of a theme park. The schedule of the 50-meter pool cycled through open lap swims, team practices, master's swim sessions, and rec swims, with teenage lifeguards moving the center divider seamlessly and like clockwork around lap swimmers so no one's routines would be disturbed. I savored the rhythm of the summer days. In tiny Winters, California, the Bobby Greenwood Pool sits right next to the public library and behind the high school. Bobby Greenwood, a living legend of Winters, settled there as a young woman and built a pool out of her love of swimming for all the Winters children to enjoy. I swam there for a rather embarrassing fee of $1, although I did have to change in the restroom and dry off with paper towels, as a group of 10-year-old boys darted back and forth between the library and the pool. Dodge City, Kansas, recently built a brand new pool called, what else? The Long Branch Lagoon, in keeping with the town's Wild West theme. When we visited, the center was quickly becoming hugely popular with the town's kids, with its water slides, 50-meter pool, kids splash, everything. Best of all for me, the pool opened very early for lap swimmers and the small swim team. Some of those swimmers were waiting eagerly outside the gates by 6:30 in the morning. I had to be a little more resourceful to find my way to the lakes and rivers around America. Sometimes, I admit, I jumped in and swam just to say I did it. One of those occasions involved the very chilly Snake River in Clarkston, Washington, in the heart of Lewis and Clark country. The Snake River was a bit scary to swim in, which should not be surprising given what one interpretation of the name conjured up for me. As part of a Great Lakes personal swimming mission, I swam along the tame eastern shore of Lake Michigan in Holland. It recalled my hometown of Vermilion, Ohio, on the south shore of Lake Erie, with families, beach chairs and umbrellas, kids frolicking, and sailboats darting back and forth closely offshore. I also swam in Lake Erie in Erie, Pennsylvania, with 11 different Presque Isle beaches. I couldn't find a swimmable spot in Duluth's Lake Superior, or on the edge of the Bay of Fundy in Eastport, Maine, but I did swim off the coast of Portland, where it was so cold that I braved my way in, warmed up a little, then rather soon jumped out before I froze to death. I understood why our host insisted on spotting me while I swam, lest I pass out and slip under from the cold, unnoticed. The edge of Lake Champlain was sparkling clear but rocky and cold, so I quickly gave it up and scampered over to Burlington's YMCA pool instead. And Chautauqua Lake was murky, foggy, and wavy in August, but I swam anyway.
Fresno, California. When I was growing up, Fresno and the other main cities of California's Central Valley, Stockton, Merced, Modesto, were in my imagination just farther north versions of Riverside or San Bernardino. Modesto, where the director George Lucas had grown up, was distinctive as the setting of the 1970s movie American Graffiti, but beyond that, I would have had trouble giving details on how the cities differed or how their prospects compared. The Central Valley is an even starker illustration of California's coast and interior contrast than the Inland Empire of San Bernardino and Riverside, and of America's conjunction of wealth and poverty as well. Starting around 2013, a tech world venture capitalist was proposing that California be split into six states. As a sign of California's human scale, if the population were equally divided into six, each one of the new states would have more people than most of today's existing states. That was not going to happen, but if it had, the proposed new state of Central California, with Fresno as its assumed capital and the Central Valley as its main territory, would have been one of the richest states in agricultural output, as by far the leading source of fruits and vegetables in the country, but the poorest in terms of per capita income. Within California, it has the highest unemployment rates and incidence of poverty, and the most serious pollution and public health challenges. The first brief exploratory look we had at Fresno was not encouraging. We arrived near dusk and checked into a battered downtown hotel. Walking the streets after dark seemed dicey enough that we decided to stay in the hotel and eat sandwiches and granola bars rather than going on foot to look for restaurants. What we saw of Fresno's historic downtown the next day, especially the famed Fulton Street Shopping Mall that in the 1960s had been celebrated as an example of progressive urban design, and in the 2010s was full of pawn shops and used clothing bodegas, made us think that Fresno was mainly an example of the before stage of civic recovery. But through the course of follow-up visits that year and afterward, there was no city about which we changed our minds more fully than Fresno. The first time we heard the cheesy civic booster motto, "Fresno? It's Fres, yes!" all we noticed was the cheesiness. After a while, we started saying it ourselves, with the understanding that the corny tone was self-aware and was part of the city's effort to turn its challenges and no-frills image into sources of "we'll show you" motivation. As we'd seen in Mississippi, in West Virginia, in San Bernardino, and in places in between, individuals and communities in smaller town America can be acutely aware of being condescended to by big city fashionable America. That awareness, the realization of connoting the opposite of the Bay Area, or Cambridge, or West Side LA, plays a part in their efforts at turnaround. When Governor Jerry Brown announced that construction for California's controversial, and in my view strategically valuable, north-south high-speed rail line would begin neither in the north, around San Francisco, nor in the south, around Los Angeles or San Diego, but instead in the middle, in Fresno, comedians and critical politicians began calling it the train to nowhere. Nowhere, of course, is where the people of Fresno live. Sometimes condescension is spirit-breaking. Sometimes it is motivating. Solving problems any place is valiant, but if you can solve them in Fresno, you can solve them anywhere. An entrepreneur named Jake Soberall, then in his early 30s, told us during our first visit to Fresno. By this time, we had learned to recognize an attitude we had observed in many other places, from Maine to Mississippi to southern Arizona. Namely, a determination to respond to difficult circumstances so as to shape, rather than just accept, a city's long-term fate. Soberall grew up in nearby Clovis, went east to Hofstra and then the University of North Carolina for college, and worked as a big city lawyer. He was the commencement speaker at Clovis High School, and he later told a business magazine, "I can distinctly remember sitting up there, this arrogant 18-year-old, thinking, you know, these folks really ought to enjoy this speech, because they'll never see me here again." But he came back to Fresno to try to develop Fresno's own technology businesses and, crucially, also to train its community college, non-college, and non-high school degree populations for better opportunities in the tech world. "If this project can work right here," he said, "in the middle of a lot of the biggest challenges facing American cities, what might it do elsewhere?" Local boosterism is a familiar part of the American fabric. But the effort in Fres-Yes seemed worth notice as something more than self-delusion or salesmanship. On our second trip to Fresno, we got an appointment with Ashley Swearengen and her staff. Swearengen, a striking blonde woman with large light blue eyes, then in her early 40s, was in her second term as Fresno's mayor. Deb says that her first reaction to Swearengen was distractingly stunning, and her second was embarrassed to have that reaction, given Swearengen's professionalism and laser-like focus. Swearengen was a liberal Republican in a strongly Democratic state, but she had proven very popular. She was elected with 55% of the vote in 2008 and re-elected with 75% 4 years later. But because of California's term limit laws, she could not do what Knox White had done in Greenville, or Gary Doty in Duluth, or even the controversial Ed Pawlowski in Allentown, and stay in the job as long as she retained support. She would be termed out in 2016, so she knew that the clock was running out on getting her long-term plans underway. When we saw her in her office, she walked over to two large-scale maps on the wall, which she said summed up the city's challenge. The problem boiled down to sprawl. One of the maps showed the city's structures by date of construction. The classic downtown, on a grid pattern with imposing banks and department stores, was built from the late 1800s through World War II. Then, the standard post-war developments, with shopping centers and tract home estates, sprawled their way north of town until they hit the natural limit of the San Joaquin River. One of the northernmost and newest developments was, of course, named San Joaquin River Estates. The other map plotted out the city's residents by income. The poorest districts had the darkest blue coloring. The richest were in red. Not surprisingly, for cities that were still in the sprawl dispersion rather than downtown recovery phases of development, there was a near-perfect correlation between the two maps. The older and closer to downtown the part of Fresno, the poorer and the less white its residents were. The city's population as a whole is roughly half Latino, the downtown districts much more so. The newer and farther away from downtown, the whiter and richer the residents. I wanted to ask Swearengen about her plans. "Fresno," I began, "is famous as a victim of sprawl." "I'm not sure I'd use the word victim," she broke in. "We were the perpetrators. It wasn't anyone's malign intention, but these were the unintended consequences of not having a strategic view. No one was thinking that just because you're swinging hammers and punching out subdivisions, you're not creating employment levels or an urban core. Among the most dramatic results was the devastation of what had once been the city's pride, its pedestrian-only Fulton Mall. "This is why I ran in 2008," she said, as she pointed at the maps that presented a vision for the city's potential revival through changes in transport lines and